Hello. I'm going to break the mood a little bit, I think, from the last two very wonderful talks. I find myself a little bit envious of some of my colleagues who are able to, focus on such close readings of individual works, and I think my obligation here today is really to speak about this exhibition that I'm organizing, which opens in Los Angeles in about 5 weeks. I want to first, just as others have said, but add my comments to and really say that it was an amazing and actually quite surprising thing to arrive at MoMA about a year ago and find out that, in fact, there was a lively and extremely dedicated group of colleagues already talking about women artists, women's art, feminist art, and so on. We now meet more frequently and longer than any other group that I'm involved with at the museum, I'm happy to say. And I'm really grateful for their support of this exhibition. Also, I want to thank Sarah Peter, of course, our patroness today, and but also Glenn Lowry, who since my coming here has been very supportive of not only my work on WAC, Art and the Feminist Revolution, but very supportive of it coming to PS1, which it will do about a year from now. And I also must thank Alana Heiss, Klaus Biesenbach, and Eugenie Tsai, and the other great staff at PS1 for their support. Alana and I are beginning to work on a kind of companion exhibition for when the show comes here that will, we hope, kind of expand the context and discourse around the show for the New York venue. And then I just want to also acknowledge in the audience Maura Riley and Linda Nochlin, whose exhibition Global Feminisms is, of course, opening at the Brooklyn Museum at the Sackler Center about, I think, just a couple weeks after we open in Los Angeles. And I think that their exhibition, in many ways, I believe, will address some of the questions that have been raised about a younger generation of artists and their relationships to the terms that we're talking about. Also, just I think it goes without saying that I, like many in this room, are sort of awestruck and starstruck by who's here, and I just want to acknowledge the work of the many artists in the room, both in my exhibition and not in my exhibition, whose work really is the foundation, I think, for the curatorial practice that I'm engaged in. So what I'm going to do is kind of go through at a whirlwind speed. What you're going to see actually is spreads from the exhibition catalog in an almost final form. I thought that rather than, sort of speak about just a few artists, it was better to give you a kind of overall impression of the exhibition. So I really apologize for the sort of the leveling out effect that this will have on many wonderful practices and artists. And also the titles that you will see up in the left-hand corner actually are titles of the themes around which the book is organized and the show is organized, although those themes will not be kind of called out in the exhibition. But again, as we have been trying to parse out various terms, I feel continually sort of critical about actually even imposing these terms on this work. But we can talk more about that later. During the late 1960s and early 70s, feminism fundamentally changed contemporary art practice, critiquing its assumptions and radically altering its structures and methodologies. But what exactly is feminism? And following that, what is feminist art? Peggy Phelan has offered what seems to me a serviceable definition of feminism, the conviction that gender has been and continues to be a fundamental category for the organization of culture. Moreover, the pattern of that organization usually favors men over women. To this, I would add another definition by Angela Davis of what she calls progressive art. Progressive art can assist people to learn not only about the objective forces at work in the society in which they live, but also about the intensely social character of their interior lives. Ultimately, it can propel people towards social emancipation. WAC, Art and the Feminist Revolution, is predicated on the notion this notion that gender was and remains fundamental to the organization of culture, and that a contemporary understanding of the feminist in art must necessarily look to the late 1960s and 70s. And I'm going to just occasionally parenthetically refer to a few images. This is a very wonderful work by Rose English, who may not be familiar to everybody in the room. She is a London-based artist who for many years has been making kind of theater-length performances, but her early work in the mid-70s, in which she collaborated with the filmmaker Sally Potter, was, and this actually is a work of her own, not a collaborative work, but what was startling to me about, for myself, discovering this work, though the work is not unknown in the UK by any means, was in fact its that it functions as a sort of direct antecedent to artists currently practicing like Matthew Barney. And I'm going to try in this talk to actually bring in the names of some artists who emerged in the 1990s, which we haven't really done so much yet, I guess. The exclamatory title of the exhibition is intended to recall the bold idealism that characterized the feminist movement during that period. Like the transformative power of pop art, memorably chronicled in Barbara Haskell's 1984 exhibition Blam, The Explosion of Pop, Minimalism, and Performance, 1958 to 1964 at the Whitney Museum, the impact of feminist art has yet to be fully theorized and accepted by museum institutions. The presence of the dinner party, of course, at the Sackler Center at the Brooklyn Museum will begin to change that in interesting ways, I think. Though WAC is not an acronym, it gestures to those of many activist groups and political communities of the 1970s whose activities focused on women's issues and cultural production. And many of those, a number of those Lucy addressed in her talk on Friday, such as the Art Workers Coalition, Women Artists in Revolution, Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell, or Witch, Women's Caucus for Art, Women's Students and Artists for Black Art Liberation, Wasabal, and many others. So it was very important to me, although it will undoubtedly be lost on many viewers, that WAC have this kind of social grounding, the title itself. The sexual and even violent connotations of WAC serve to reinforce feminism's affront to the patriarchal system, while the exhibition's conjoined subtitle, Art and the Feminist Revolution, is intended to acknowledge the intersection of feminism and art that is this exhibition, that is at the core of the exhibition. My ambition for the show is to make the case that, and this, I hope this will be shared or a shared sentiment by this audience, though not by perhaps the broader audience, but to make the case that feminism's impact on art of the 1970s constitutes the most influential international movement or impulse of any during the post-war period, in spite of, or perhaps because of the fact that it seldom cohered formally or critically into a movement the way abstract expressionism, minimalism, fluxus, other movements did. For that reason, I want to invoke bell hooks' proposal to resignify the term feminist movement, as was done earlier, I think, in the conference, to deliver it from its fixity and reconnect it to the verb to move, with all the restless possibility that word connotes. Moreover, I want to assert that feminism constitutes and demands an ideology of shifting criteria, one influenced and mediated by myriad other factors. Whereas art movements traditionally defined by charismatic individuals, men, often, tend to be explicated and debated through manifestos and other kinds of writings, feminism is a relatively open-ended system that has, throughout its history of engagement with visual art, sustained an unprecedented degree of internal critique and contained widely divergent political ideologies and practices. Many of the artists in WAC do not necessarily identify themselves or their work as feminist. Nonetheless, to quote Susan Hiller, whose work is in the exhibition, art practice with no overt political content may nevertheless be able to sensitize us politically, of course. It's my contention that whether unintentionally or lacking the language or cultural context to support a feminist idiom, the artists in this exhibition contributed to the movement and development of feminism in art, if only by reinforcing two central tenets. The personal is political, and all representation is political. Through a proposed dismantling of the received canon of feminist art, the exhibition and accompanying publication, hopefully, and consciously reenact feminism's legacy of inclusivity and its interrogation of cultural hierarchies of all kinds to suggest a more complicated history of simultaneous feminisms. While the American feminist art movement is embedded within it, this international exhibition of 120 artists, activists, filmmakers, writers, teachers, and thinkers necessarily moves beyond the now canonical list of American feminist artists to include women of other geographies, formal approaches, socio-political alliances, and critical and theoretical positions. I love this because it's actually, we tried very hard in many cases to move beyond the known images of certain works, the very often published images. So I love this kind of acrobatic version of Carolee's interior scroll. There's considerable debate over the origins of feminist art. However, it's not the project of this exhibition to write the narrative of its inception. Rather, I prefer to gesture to the proliferation of practices that revolutionized the production and discourse of art and whose impact was felt globally. Certainly during the late 1960s and 70s in the United States, New York and California in particular, but also Chicago, Minneapolis, Houston, many places in the country, and the UK, there were organized centers for feminist art and activism. Thanks in part, of course, to the groundbreaking works of critics and historians, many of whom are here today. However, as Marcia Meskimen has adroitly argued, assertions that feminism in art emanated from these centers through a kind of global ripple effect merely replicates a colonialist model and does not acknowledge the importance of artists working in their own communities and/or in dialogue with other artists elsewhere. The globalized, spatialized model that Meskimen and others have put forth as an alternative recognizes that while individual practices may have initially occurred in a condition of relative isolation, they often coalesce through discourse and relationship. And this is, I'll just maybe highlight this again, an artist who may not be known to everybody in this group, an artist, T. Corinne, who passed away just recently, who was a lesbian artist based in for many years in the Bay Area, and who made this work, the Cunt Coloring Book, out of work that she was doing with health groups and sort of health education groups in the Bay Area in the 70s. And she sort of came up with this vehicle of the coloring book as a way to educate women about their bodies. She also did photographs and contributed to many kind of underground lesbian journals and zines. Let's see. Myriad affinities characterize the proliferation of feminist activity in art of the late 60s and 70s. The movement of the movement that Hooks elucidates. Just one very local and regional example, which comes from Los Angeles, where I was conceiving of the exhibition, is that John Baldessari, for example, invited Ulrika Rosenbach and Gina Pane to perform and teach at CalArts and LICA, Los Angeles Institute of Contemporary Art, respectively. Though neither artist was hosted by the Feminist Art Program, it's interesting to track their contributions to feminist art in Los Angeles and beyond. Elsewhere, contemporaries and friends Zarina and Nazreen Mohammadi were equally radical as women artists working out of the repressive context of India. While Zarina emphasized the resistance against cultural traditions of representation by incorporating very specific references to transculturalism, Mohammadi manifested her urban architectonic vision through photographs and subtle abstract manipulations. Within the framework of this exhibition, the work of these two artists, working abstractly but from very different cultural contexts, New York eventually for Zarina, and India for Mohammadi, although she left and studied in London and went back, can be considered in relationship to feminism, though they did not engage in the same critical terms as their Western counterparts. For many of the artists in WAC, feminism often coexisted with political engagement on other fronts. such as race, class, or sexual orientation, which may at times have superseded feminism as the dominant discourse within which they preferred to situate their work. I'm going to hold on this for a moment. Here in the United States, this is particularly evident with regard to women artists whose feminism evolved out of a deep engagement with the civil rights movement, such as Faith Ringgold and the women of Where We At, whose collective activity emerged from their involvement with Black Power and the Black Arts Movement, with whom they remained closely affiliated. On the West Coast, the flagrant machismo of the Chicano movement inspired such women as Judy Baca in Los Angeles to invent a hybridized practice, community-based mural practice that generated expanded notions of community and audience. Founded in 1974, Spider Woman Theater, and you see a poster here representing their work, was the first Native American feminist performance group. They found ample material in the histories of subjugation embedded within Native women's lives, and they're still active today. Another test of feminism's relevance and resiliency occurs with artists who did not participate in and whose works did not circulate through the mainstream Reed White art world. Emily Kame Kingwari, for example, was an Australian Aboriginal artist who, during the 1970s, made textiles as part of the Utopia Women's Batik group. Their collective art-making activities became a form of social mobilization with the goal of reinstating land rights as the batiks were offered for sale through local vendors, raising both money and awareness of the plight of their people. Though Kingwari later gained recognition for her abstract paintings, which she began showing in galleries during the 1980s, she is not represented in WAC because the economy with which the Utopia Group's works of the 1970s circulated did not favor institutional collections and archives. As a curator, my own interest in so-called second wave feminist art arose not as a participant or peer, but from observing its impact on contemporary practice in the early 1990s. The influence and sometimes misappropriation that Magdalena spoke of yesterday. I concur with Holland Cotter's assertion that most of the interesting American artists of the last 30 years are as interesting as they are in part because of the feminist art movement of the early 1970s. It changed everything. And this was said in a review of two exhibitions that occurred in 2002 here in New York City, one at White Columns called Gloria and another on Long Island. And there was quite a lot of sort of discussion and critical response around these two exhibitions. Working as a curator in the early 1990s here in New York, I was involved with artists such as Janine Antoni, Zenobia Bailey, Soan Kwan, the Godzilla Group, Kathy Burkhardt, and Chris-Ann Stathakos's A Project, Abortion Project, Aki Fujiyoshi, Beverly Sims, Andrea Zittel, and others. Many engaged in the discourses coming out of the Whitney Independent Study Program around the subjects of gender and cultural difference. For me, the watershed moment was the formulation of WAC, the Women's Action Coalition, which the title is also meant to evoke, this kind of what I think of, at least in this country, as a kind of full circle moment, where activism, again, kind of situated within the art world, began to take place. So these two watershed moments. The first involved the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas debacle and the conflation of media sexism and racism that surrounded these proceedings. The second occurred around a panel discussion that many of you will remember, titled Representation and Value, What Role Will the Language of Feminism Play in the Art World of the 1990s? It was a very hopeful moment, organized at Cooper Union. And my memory of this is that, you know, something like 9,000, I don't know, many, many hundreds of people, mostly women, showed up for that panel. And it was a very big surprise, I think, to the organizers, much like today. An opportunity for dialogue on the subject of feminism and art criticism, the event was effectively hijacked, at least this is my memory of it, by the meteoric ascension of Matthew Barney, a truly unique voice whose own practice is deeply imprinted by feminist art and who himself co-ops strategies of drag, among others. His breakthrough show at Barbara Gladstone Gallery in 1991 had virtually eclipsed several other simultaneous exhibitions featuring women artists. During the panel, all critical discussion around issues of gender and sexuality seemed to coalesce around Barney's work and ignored the women artists who were exhibiting at the time. It's my recollection that this in part sparked a community-wide sense of inequity and frustration. And again, this is a very sort of particular moment, a very New York-centric history in the early 1990s. Up the street from Matthew Barney's exhibition was an exhibition at Blum-Hellman Warehouse organized by Catherine Liu called Plastic Fantastic Lover, including such artists as Polly Applebaum, Angela Bullock, Sylvie Fleury, Aki Fujiyoshi, Dominique Gonzalez-Forster, Rebecca Horn, Liz Larner, and others. Ironically, perhaps in light of the fact that all eyes seem to be on Barney at the moment, the exhibition catalog opened with the following reflection on that moment in the early 1990s. In the contemporary art world, there is a general air of confusion that could be attributed to the fact that there are no new masters who have appeared recently, or else the chaotic state of affairs could be the result of the fact that many people have simply stopped waiting for bated breath for the master's appearance. So, in many ways, the master was appearing up the street, I felt, or many of us felt. During the 1990s in New York, a dynamic group of artists emerging that I already mentioned were looking to the art and artists of the 1970s feminist movement to address a host of questions about identity, gender, and the social inscription of space. Janine Antoni's Loving Care performances of 1993, in which she dragged her own pigment-saturated hair across the floor, resonated, of course, with Linda Benglis's process-based paint pours. Even Barney's unique vision is unthinkable without Rose English, who I mentioned, but also Barbara T. Smith, Martha Wilson, Ulrika Ottinger's film Freak Artlando, and Madame X, which was the very first pairing that we saw, and Adrian Piper's Mythic Being performances. In June 1992, when the Solomon Guggenheim Museum opened the doors of its Soho space with only two, I believe, women artists in its permanent collection, WAC found a target for its first protests. The New York art world for a moment was focused in a very public way on the inequities within the art world. Employing what Lucy has called SWAT team strategies, WAC also staged demonstrations around incidences of rape, media discrimination, and anti-women's rights legislation at the time. So just a sort of quick historiography that, again, is a very primarily, I guess, North American one. The mid-1990s was marked, but again, to sort of characterize this moment, I think, and the institutional response or lack of it to an interest, a sort of renewed interest in the period of the 70s and feminist art in particular, was marked by a number of ambitious exhibitions that each addressed aspects of the legacy of feminist art. Among these were the traveling exhibition Empty Dress, Clothing as Surrogate in Recent Art, organized by Nina Felshen in 1993. More Than Minimal, Feminism and Abstraction in the 1970s, organized by Susan Stoops at the Rose Art Museum in 1996. And this featured Linda Benglis, Jackie Farrar, Nancy Graves, Eva Hesse, Anna Mendieta, Mary Miss, Ree Morton, Michelle Stewart, and others. If there is, I guess, any model or a sort of primary model for this exhibition for me, it's Inside the Visible, an Elliptical Traverse of the 20th Century, in and of and from the Feminine, which was organized in 1996 by Catherine de Zager for the Institute of Contemporary Art in Boston and then traveled to London. I admire de Zager's deeply historical, what she has called an elliptical traverse of the 20th century through the shared sensibilities of women working internationally. Other exhibitions at the time include The Bad Girl Show from 1994, the sadly titled Bad Girls West, organized, or the unfortunately titled Bad Girls West, organized in Los Angeles, Sense and Sensibility, which happened here at the Modern in 1994, Women Artists and Minimalism in the 90s, organized by Lynn Zelovansky, Sexual Politics, Judy Chicago's Dinner Party in Feminist Art History, also 1996 by Amelia Jones. And then I would just add to this sort of one or two year moment, the publishing, of course, of The Power of Feminist Art by Norma Browdy and Mary Garrard, which was...
The Division of Labor, that was a really important show.
It was, you're right, yeah. And I don't know what happened to it because it usually is in my litany of things that I talk about, so thank you. Let's see. In organizing WAC, I hope, in fact, to invoke feminist art's lofty and romantic striving for nothing less than a complete reorganization of cultural hierarchies. Rather than apologize or in some way justify certain practices that are more ephemeral, less influential, or more qualitatively uneven, I chose instead to exalt the ways in which different women artists position themselves vis-a-vis the feminist movement, making the question of selection criteria critical for any exhibition, of course, most, I imagine, controversial here. First, I think the presentation had to be visually extremely powerful and compelling, a powerful experience that would linger in one's visual memory. And this is a little bit addresses the issue that I encountered often early on. You know, what are you going to do with all the bad art? I was asked many times. And had to actually, you know, face a certain kind of internalized notion that I had also of what I would be looking at. Over the course of thinking about this project, I resolved that a survey exhibition that takes to heart feminist strategies of resistance disrupts canon formation and supports intentionality, narrative, and biography would contain a wide range of practices that each function differently within multiple frames of organization. For that reason, I felt some artists' roles as activists, critics, and organizers were equally important or more compelling and important to represent. I know, and it's also in, yeah, I apologize to Joan for this slide. As I said, this is a slightly earlier version of the publication, so. Thank you. Which we all know because of Richard's talk yesterday. A critical aspect of my research was the interrogation of every aspect of the construction of feminist art's historical narrative. Since a fundamental goal of feminist thought and practice, of course, was the complete reimagining of history's past and present. Initially, the project was broader in scope, examining the period from the 50s through the 70s, 50s through the 80s at one point, but I can quickly concluded that the shift that happened because of the civil rights movement and other events of the late 1960s, that the art produced before and after was fundamentally different in its social grounding, and I decided instead to focus on the decade of the 70s, the sort of lost decade, as we've talked about a little bit. Yet I was also aware of the problems of decade-based historical models and the ways in which they don't account for for proliferation on a global scale. In this case, the feminist art in the case of feminist art, once consideration moves beyond the United States, with its domination of publishing and scholarship, a new, more elliptical model immediately surfaces, as we've talked about numerous times over the last day and a half. In examining the 1970s, many institutions have tended to privilege conceptual art, sometimes overlooking the debate around feminist art that still brackets conceptualism. And I think particularly outside of the United States, this has been interesting that it's sort of okay to resuscitate certain practices through conceptual art, but not okay to frame them as feminist. There are two issues that I rethought constantly, and I'm going to try to just finish up shortly, during the organization of the show. The first was whether or not to include male artists, and in fact, early on in a conversation with Catherine about Inside the Visible, as she was looking retrospectively at the show, she said the first thing she said was that she regretted not including men in the exhibition. It was her contention was that most women artists want to have their work seen in an equitable situation where history is evaluated by criteria other than the sociopolitical or gender-based mandates of the all-woman group show. I fielded this past many of the artists that I visited as a way to break the ice, although it was often a strange icebreaker, as it turned out. But thanks to many, in fact, quite tough discussions with Susan Hiller, Sturdivant, Mary Kelly, many others, including quite recently Lily DeJury, who almost as recently as like 2 months ago made me sort of nearly turn the whole thing upside down and rethink it yet again. All, I think, in the end agreed that it was very important to have this exhibition only honor and show the work of the women artists involved, and in fact that the next exhibition can take and many other next exhibitions can take other strategies. It seemed that a major institutional survey of some kind telling one version of this essential story of the 70s must be told first. The second issue that I went back and forth about was that of structure. My earliest impulse was to sort of abandon all traditional installation models for survey exhibitions, which ran the gamut from a conversation which Moira Roth told me to just abandon all the work altogether and just bring everyone back together for consciousness-raising groups, record those discussions, and project them into the space, which I love the idea of. But I love objects. I couldn't do it. So we are hoping in various ways through programming, educational programming, which we can talk about if anyone wants, to echo that, those kinds of discussions. During a conversation with Mary Kelly, she questioned why women artists should not benefit from the same kinds of selection criteria as their male counterparts. In other words, why can't women artists be represented in greater depth as the work and the contribution to issues of the exhibition's themes and narrative demanded? And of course, she was entirely right, I think. So in the end, what we have is a sort of structure in which themes, as I hope you can begin to see, were conceived as propositions rather than as definitive strategies, which is also why they won't be kind of emblazoned on the wall as you go through. Can a work exist in dialogue with that of other international contexts and parallel concerns? If an artist's work appears radically singular in nature, solitary, and unresponsive to a group context, what might this mean in terms of constructing counterarguments within the exhibition? Are there categories and practices that resist the feminist art movement in productive ways? This was another, this artist's work was another sort of personal discovery for me. She's a German artist who's worked outside of Frankfurt for many years, who comes out of printmaking, and then kind of through her training in printmaking practices and etching and so on, began to make photographs where she etches into and sews into these kind of performative photographs in various ways. Also a maker of video. It's my hope that the themes provide multiple entries into the work, while some artists are present in greater depth and in multiple themes, as befitting their contribution, I think, to the larger discourse. I've attempted to present a narrative that is open-ended, elliptical, and discursive in its consideration of a diverse and powerful range of practices. Perhaps I'll just stop here. I was going to just go on and describe some of the themes to you, but I think I'm feeling increasingly strange about these themes, I think, today. So I will take this opportunity to close. And we're, I think, just about through this. I'm sure many of you know this work. This is a work by Nikki de Saint-Phalle, which no longer exists. This is a maquette that we'll have, but this is actually a work that she made at the Moderna Museet in Stockholm, where the audience, I don't think I have a picture of it, but where the audience actually entered the vagina there, the void, and inside viewed an art exhibition of replicas that were made by a Swedish artist that she collaborated with, of kind of masterpieces, Pollock and others. There was a sculpture by Tingley and a milk bar and a film viewing room. So it was this kind of fantastic activated exhibition space that she made. It's my ambition that the exhibition will make the case, as I said, that the feminist art movement was and remains the most influential of any post-war. I think this is evident in the work we see around us today, not necessarily in Chelsea, of course, but in the strategies of Women on Waves, for example, or Coco Fusco's complicated and deeply disturbing performance personas. That the relevance and resonance of this work you see on the screen is self-evident, in part through the lens of our contemporary vision and understanding of how current practices can meaningfully intervene in and honor historical precedent. I can only see this feminist work in this way and hope that this exhibition gives evidence.